Hey, welcome to episode 346 of the Fantastic Forecast. I'm Dave Elliott, and you can sleep with mutants if you want to. Do whatever you want with them. Just don't bring any mutants to my house. On today's episode, Fantastic Four, 346 from November 1990, 70 million years BC, and then some, by Walter Simonson. Out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the Fantastic Five and a group of army troops are stranded on an island that, thanks to that pesky time bubble, has been dropped down in from millions of years in the past, when dinosaurs roamed the Earth and the TV show The Simpsons was still funny. Now, thanks to that pesky time bubble again, the island is being sucked back into the past a little bit at a time, meaning that the island is getting smaller and smaller, which is not good news for the people stranded on the island. So far, they've lost their time sled, and all the stuff Reed could have used to create a signal device to ask for help, which is what he should have done the first thing when they crash-landed. Sharon takes a moment to point out something. She's been looking at some of the plant life on the island, and she's recognized some Mesozoic-era plant life, some Jurassic-era plants, along with most of the plants which are Cretaceous-era plants, and there's some plants from the Triassic period. Hold on a second. How the hell did Sharon Ventura become an expert on ancient plant life? She was a friggin' female wrestler. I guess she's one of those female wrestlers with a PhD in paleobotany. Thanks to this, she's able to recognize that the oldest parts of the island have disappeared first. So Reed figures they better go hang out on the youngest part of the island. One of the army troops gets the jitters. What's the use, man? We're all dead, man! There's no way out of this death trap, man! We'll never make it home! Reed tells him to relax. He's with the Fantastic Four. And they've never lost before. Besides, even without their powers, they have Reed on their side, which means they have nothing to worry about. Johnny, meanwhile, is lost in thought. He's been thinking a lot about that Nebula lady who took over his mind for a few issues during the whole time bubble story. He can't get her out of his mind, and wonders how and if he should tell his wife when he gets back home. Later, the FF and the troops have chopped down some trees and are putting together a large raft. Reed worries that they might not just be trapped on the island, but in the time pocket as well. So they start running out of trees where they are, and Ben, in his thing outfit, says that he and the FF will go collect more trees and bring them back. As they walk off, Ben's got his arm around Sharon, and Reed tells Johnny and Sue to let them go on ahead so they can have a little privacy. Ben tells Sharon that she seems pretty happy lately and asks her why, and she replies, "Can't you guess?" And he figures it's because she's a human again, a human woman. She says she never liked being a woman in a man's world, but being the she-thing gave her so much power, she finally felt like a real person. But now, with her being in love with Ben, even without her rocky hide, she feels reborn. She worries that if she leaves the island, she might lose her humanity again. And boy, can Ben ever relate to that. It's like with him and that Beyonder plan in Secret Wars. A few hours later, the FF are pulling down trees and stuff, and Johnny's complaining about how hard it is without his flame powers, and things are starting to get boring. So as you can figure, this is the perfect time for them to get attacked by a T-Rex. Yes, one of them comes running out of the forest right toward Ben. The creature swoops Ben up into its mouth. Sharon yells out for Ben to do something, but Ben replies that something's wrong with his suit, like the T-Rex's teeth broke something. So now it's up to the powerless members of the FF to save his life and do something. With homemade spears, which they use to jab into the T-Rex's legs, causing him to drop the thing. Before the dinosaur can attack Reed and the others, Sharon tosses a spear, and it sticks right into the T-Rex's chest beside its arm. So now, it turns and runs towards Sharon. And she turns, and she runs away from the T-Rex. But the ground starts to crumble under both of them, and they fall off a cliff. Ben and the others rush over, worried that Sharon is dead. But they find her hanging off a vine on the side of the cliff. It appears that another chunk of the island has just disappeared back into time. So Reed tells everyone to grab the rolled-up vines they have and get the hell out of there. They gotta make it back to the Jurassic Cretaceous border. So they get to the next section of the island, just as the area behind them disappears back into time. Sharon pulls Ben aside and tells him that she was wrong earlier. No way does she want to stay on this island. She'd rather be a living thing than a dead woman. Then suggests that maybe Reed can help her turn back into a human if she turns back into a she-thing. He's really optimistic about that, don't you think? Considering how often Reed has failed at helping Ben. And he only did cure Ben, finally. By accident. He says he's not angry at her for wanting to stay, but they probably couldn't stay for more than a week without being somebody's lunch. Then he adds, I gotta admit, kissing you here is a lot of fun. And I'm sure they did more than kissing. Johnny's looking at him and preparing to toss a stone at the two. What a dick. And Sue tells her brother that he better not even think about it. 2 days later, the army troops are putting the finishing touches on a huge raft when, blam, the volcano in the middle of the island erupts. Of course. We knew that would happen. Nobody thinks that's a good sign, and they better haul ass off the island. Ben, in his thing suit, pulls the raft away from the shore as people load it up with supplies and hop on board. Pretty soon, they're all on the raft, moving away from the island, paddling along, when, clunk, they ram right into an invisible wall. And it's not Sue's invisible wall. Reed says it's just like he figured. They're stuck behind a time barrier. Ben pounds on the wall, but he can't break through. And if that's not bad enough, a big sea dinosaur pops its head out to say hello, or maybe to eat them. Reed, probably to eat them. Reed recognizes it as a Kronosaurus, the largest known plesiosaur. Of course, the army troops don't care to know anything about a plesiosaur. They just want to shoot it with their guns. Ben, meanwhile, is banging on that wall so hard, his thing suit is starting to short out. The Kronosaurus rams into the raft and starts to topple over, but a portal opens in the wall to the time barrier, and the raft floats through. They look back at the island and see it disappear and fade back into the past. Of course, all the logs and the vines that make up the raft, they get sucked back into the past as well. And so with the raft gone, everyone falls over into the water. Now they're all floating out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The army troops think they're screwed, but everyone starts rising up out of the water, and soon they're all completely out and standing comfortably on a new raft, an invisible force field raft created by Sue. So it seems that the members of the FF have their powers back. Johnny yells out, "Yo!" and he flames on. He flies up into the air. Reed uses his stretchy arms to pull a few guys out of the water. The army lieutenant apologizes to Reed for not believing they were the FF earlier. Sue creates an invisible sail to help them along and says that Johnny should be able to bring back help. And then finally, we check in on Sharon Ventura, who's crying. Her skin is getting hard again. Her hair disappears. And soon, she's the she-thing again. Yay, we can all breathe a sigh of relief. Reed assures her that they'll do everything they can to help her when they get home. Finally, the story ends with an epilogue at a large office filled with desks and bureaucratic workers in a place that exists outside of time. It's the Time Variance Authority. They keep track of all kinds of time abnormalities, time travel shenanigans, and stuff like that. They have concluded that the Fantastic Four's adventure is over, and all the temporal disruptions have been repaired, and everything is back to normal. Yay! Of course, that's not going to last very long. We got more time travel shenanigans on the way, because it's time for Fantastic Forecast, Episode 346, Part 2. Today, Fantastic Four, Annual 23 from 1990, When Franklin Comes Marching Home, by Walter Simonson and Jackson Geis. So it's time for another annual from back in the day when all the annuals were 64 pages, way too long, and were part of a crossover with other annuals after the Marvel annuals of 1988 and 1989, which comprised two long crossovers, The Evolutionary War and Atlantis Attacks. The 1990 annuals are broken down into smaller crossovers. FF Annual 23 is part one of a four-part crossover with the X-Men family of annuals, Days of Future Present. So let's get started. So we begin in New York City with the Fantastic Four returning home in the Fantasticar. I'm not sure when this story takes place, but the She-Thing is there, and Ben is there in his human form. Franklin is with them, so they're not returning home from the events in issue 346. They arrive home and find that their headquarters is gone. The building, the Four Freedoms Plaza, isn't even there anymore, but in its place is the old Baxter Building. Uh-oh. I see more time shenanigans. Reed runs a scan and everything seems to be normal, so they land in a nearby park and decide to approach the building on foot. They think it's odd that the average New Yorkers on the street don't seem to notice that anything is out of the ordinary. When they arrive at the entrance, Reed says it looks like an exact replica of the old building, right down to the weathering and the old water stains. Inside the lobby, Ben tries his ID card on the special FF elevator, but it doesn't work. Reed sees the old doorman, O'Houlihan, and asks what he's doing. He seems surprised to see the FF. He didn't see them leave the building. Sue has one of the old belt buckle lights from the old days on her uniform, and she tries that on the elevator, and it works. So they head upstairs. O'Houlihan thinks there's something strange about the thing, and that guy in the trench coat looks like Ben Grimm to him. So he calls upstairs, and he gets Dr. Richards. In the elevator, Reed tells everyone to be on guard. O'Houlihan retired several years ago, so something isn't quite right here. They get out of the elevator and find themselves attacked by the building's automatic defenses. Sue protects herself and Franklin with a force field. Sharon starts ripping these metal tentacles that are trying to grab them and yanking them out of the wall. And Reed whips out a handy-dandy pulse gun, which he fires and overloads and burns out the sensors that are activating the automatic defenses. He better hope that Dr. Doom isn't reading this issue. I'm sure a pulse gun would go right to the top of his Christmas wish list. Franklin is crying, and Sue tells him that everything is fine, but the kid says, "No, you don't understand. There's something really, really bad here." Oh, yeah, well, the plot of the entire crossover, that's what. Reed wants to go examine the control room, but he and the FF get there, they look around, and it seems like the old Baxter Building control room, even though I remember old maps of the old Baxter Building, and I don't recall ever seeing a so-called control room. Ben notices one thing odd about the room. There's another version of the Fantastic Four in the room, with the old black and blue uniforms. Sue's got her 1960s hairstyle, the same hairstyle worn by my mother to this very day, by the way. There's an old Ben Grimm as a thing, and he sees the future FF, and he says that it's clobbering time. Franklin is confused. How can these be the bad people he was thinking about? Next, the 1960s FF and the 1990 FF start fighting it out. The old Sue doesn't seem to recognize Franklin as she's pelting her older self with invisible force balls. But really, the invisible woman should be wiping the floor with the invisible girl, but she's not. The she-thing jumps in to help her boyfriend, but gets tossed aside by the 1960s thing. The two human torches are fighting, the invisible girl captures 1990 Reed in a force field, and soon, all the 1990 FF are captured. And the old Reed puts them under the microscope to study them and concludes they are perfectly identical versions of themselves. He concludes they're either from the future or from an alternate timeline. Or clones! What about clones? He doesn't think about that. 1990 Reed says there's a third option, and it's not clones. He says this could be their present, and the old FF are shadows from the past. 1960s Reed says that's impossible. 1990 Reed asks them why the Baxter Building is still standing. Where is Four Freedoms Plaza? How come Reed and Sue don't have a son? The Invisible Girl says they do have a son, and she points over to this grown man with blonde hair. It's an adult Franklin. Oh no, I hate the adult Franklin stories. The older Franklin starts freaking out, saying that the 1990 FF doesn't belong there. The Invisible Woman says that the 1960s FF are just a creation of his imagination. Little boy Franklin is freaking out too, saying, "Mommy, help me, I'm scared. He's not your Franklin, I am." Older Franklin says, "I remember too much. It's becoming real. The child's mind, trapped forever." He goes flying out, crashing through the wall, yelling, "I can't stand anymore." With the adult Franklin gone, the illusions disappear. Gone are the 1960s FF, and the 1990 FF are back at Four Freedoms Plaza. But things aren't over. The entire top of the building is surrounded by a force field, trapping everyone inside. Meanwhile, over on the west coast of England, Megan and Rachel Summers, members of Excalibur, are relaxing on the beach. Megan asks Rachel how much about the future that she came from can she remember, but Rachel says her memories of the future are a little bit scrambled. Kind of like my memories of the Steve Englehart run and the FF are kind of scrambled. We block bad memories sometimes. The girls hear a loud crash. Rachel says she has to go. She feels something she hasn't felt. in a long time. Back in New York, the X-Men, Banshee and Forge, yes, Banshee and Forge, ooh, big guest stars, Banshee and Forge, are hanging out when old Franklin pops up saying he was looking for his old teachers but realizes they're not so old right now, so he freaks out and says at Four Freedoms Plaza his mom was right, and he rushes back there. Banshee and Forge figure they better head back that way too. Elsewhere, and I do mean elsewhere, at some place between here and now, quote-unquote, they say, in a crypt, an alarm goes off, and this old, half-cyborg-looking alien creature wakes up, and he says, "It has finally happened. Prepare to launch the Sentinel Warp Attack." Ooh, the Sentinel Warp Attack. Over at an apartment on the west side, Dr. Power comes home, father of the super team, kid super team Power Pack. The kids say they're playing hide-and-seek with Franklin, and they find him, and it's not the young Franklin, it's the old Franklin. Back at FF headquarters, Rita's having a hard time taking down the force field around the building. Sue says they need to find the older Franklin, and Reed says they'll need to remove the mind locks on young Franklin's mind so he can use his powers. Out on the street, Forge and Banshee reach the FF building and see the force field around the top. Banshee's powers, the powers where he screams his ass off, which really must be the worst and most annoying superpower ever, and Forge's gun are useless against a force field. Back inside, an alarm goes off and the FF look out the window and see these little flying drones attacking the building. Are they being attacked from 24 years in the future by President Obama? No, I guess it's just the Sentinel Warp Attack. These little drones crash into the building and they start wrecking up the place. The FF put up a fight, but it's Sue who scoops them all up in a force field. Since they've been captured, the drones self-destruct, and in the process, this destroys the force field around the top of the building. Forge and Banshee arrive, and they tell the FF about their encounter with the adult Franklin. So now, they just need to find him. Sharon asks little Franklin if he could be any place, where would it be? He says he would be with his friends, the Powers. So the FF travel over to pay a visit to the Power family. Now the young Power kids are surprised to see another Franklin with the FF, and only then do they realize they've been playing with an adult Franklin. But he screwed with their minds and made him think he was a kid. Boy, I bet there's a lot of Catholic priests and Hollywood producers who wish they had that power. Reed tells adult Franklin that they want to help him, so he joins the FF in their Fantastic Car, and on the way home, Franklin notices the massive X-Factor building in the middle of the town and says, "That's not right," and he disappears. Yes, he sees a big building in the New York City skyline that doesn't exist in the future where he comes from. I'm sure there's a few of those. So they land back on the roof of the Four Freedoms Plaza, and Reed tells the FF and Banshee and Forge that he's got some scanners they're able to use to detect adult Franklin's energy readings, so they split up and they decide to search the city, and the story ends with one group tracking Franklin right towards the X-Factor building, and that is the end of Days of Future Present Part 1, to be continued later, of course, in the X-Factor annual. But first, we got a little ways to go in this FF annual. First, we've got backup stories. Oh man, boy, do I love backup stories, especially in annuals. They're always so good to make fun of. And the first one is Cast in Fire, Carved in Stone by James Brock Jr. Not James Brock Sr., James Brock Jr. and Mark McKenna. It begins, ironically, in those other buildings that don't exist in the future, the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. And it seems Dr. Doom has an office there. Maybe that's why he was crying in that terrible Spider-Man 9/11 issue. He's running some scans on a couple of women, women who he gave power to back on the battle world in Secret Wars 1. And first, he's looking at Marcia Rosenberg, Volcana. Yes, it's a Volcana solo story. It's about time. So we get a brief summary of her appearances so far, her start back in Secret Wars 1, her romance with Molecule Man, and the merging of Molecule Man and the Beyonder into a cosmic cube, which I think was part of the Steve Englehart run, if I remember correctly, but my memory, as I've said, is a little scrambled of that run. Volcana, of course, was grief-stricken at the loss of her super-powered boy toy, and Dr. Doom, of course, wants some of that Molecule Man power. He tracked down Volcana when she was in the middle of fighting with the wizard, and in the middle of the battle, the wizard just up and ran away. So our story really begins at that point, with Volcana sitting on the street, surrounded by the devastation from her fight with the wizard. The cops arrive, and she tells them what happened. She learns that a woman was trampled by a fleeing crowd during the chaos, so Volcana rushes off to Mercy Hospital to check her out. The cops offer to give her a ride, and even give her a gas mask to wear to cover her face, because when she turns off her powers, her face is visible. Meanwhile, during all of this, Dr. Doom is tracking her movements. In the hospital waiting room, a girl with a broken foot has her foot suddenly healed. I think this was the girl who was trampled. In fact, everyone in the waiting room has their problem suddenly healed and cured. Nearby, a couple of policemen are guarding a room with a woman. She's laying in her bed, and she's a quadriplegic. But she wakes up, and suddenly, I guess she's cured too, because she's up and walking around. Outside the hospital, a wall is blown apart, and that woman emerges in her supervillain outfit. It's Moonstone, who had been a member of the Masters of Evil over in the Avengers. I used to belong to a similar group, the Masters of the Apathetic. So Moonstone starts attacking the nearby cops, blasting police cars. Volcana knocks a cop over to save his life, and after hitting the road, she suddenly turned into rock, volcanic rock. And Dr. Doom thinks this new ability is part of the Molecule Man's powers given to her. So Volcana and Moonstone go on and fight for an unimaginable 7 pages. It finally ends with Volcana ripping the metal front off a bulldozer and whacking Moonstone across the face with it, knocking her out. Volcana ties her up in chains and leaves her for the police. The story ends back with Dr. Doom, where he's trying to figure out how to get at that Molecule Man power inside Volcana. And he says that one day, oh yes, one day, he's gonna get that power. Now in 24 years, is this a storyline that has ever been revisited? Not that I recall. Seems doubtful. So on to the second backup story, Beyond and Back, by Lynn Kaminsky and Greg Capullo. Yes, Greg Capullo, who is now, in 2014, an excellent artist, but in 1990, not so much. The tale begins in deep space, with the cosmic cube floating in space, and it explodes, and the essence of Owen Reese, Molecule Man, is sent out wherever, but we'll learn that in a story some other time, it says. The rest of the cube turns into a woman, who kind of looks like Nova, Herald of Galactus, but she's called Cosmos. Yes, essentially, this is the Beyonder, but now he's a naked yellow chick with flaming hair. She encounters another former cosmic cube, a guy called Cubic. Cosmos says that many of her former psychological defects were due to her configuration as a male being. She has many questions, and Cubic is there to offer answers. He tells her about the stars, the most precious source of energy in the universe. He shows her the Dark Phoenix, which he calls an agent of evolution. He shows her the race of the Watchers, but tells her to ignore them. They only like to watch. He tells her about these cosmic beings who are combinations of billions of other souls, Mangog, the Overmind, and the Unimind. He points out the High Evolutionary, which he calls the loneliest of all the Ascended Ones. And then there's the Stranger, an enigma, even to himself. And there's other cosmic entities like Eon, the Vishanti, and the Celestials. Cosmos says that he met many of these folks in her previous existence. So, Cubic goes on to point out other evil ones like Thanos and some other bad guys. And then there's Death, the forces of cosmic balance like Lord Chaos and Master Order, and the In-Betweener, a horny English teenage boy who also maintains the metaphysical stability of the universe. There's the Living Tribunal, and Galactus, and Eternity. Cosmos and Cubic continue to travel outside the universe, and to a place at the sub-microscopic quantum level, and they see atoms and molecules and bacteria, and they return to normal space, and Cubic's lesson is over, and Cosmos has one final question. She asks, "Where is my place in all this?" Cubic replies, Now that is a good question. And that's it. That's the end of the story. And I use the word story very, very loosely. And thank goodness, it's also the end of this Fantastic Four annual. And that takes us on to Fantastic Forecast episode 346 part 3, X-Factor, annual number 5 from 1990, Act of Faith by Louise Simonson and John Bogdanov. So we pick up the story with adult Franklin floating through the air, heading right toward the X-Factor building, which used to be Apocalypse's ship, a huge monolithic structure that dwarfs even the World Trade Center. And we also get, as a bonus, a literary quote. Faith, like a jackal, feeds among the tombs, and even from those dead doubts she gathers her most vital hope. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. I don't know what it means for this story, but I always enjoy saying Moby Dick. So, adult Franklin is looking at the X-Factor ship and saying that it doesn't belong there. Meanwhile, inside, the members of X-Factor, Cyclops, Iceman, the Beast, Archangel, and Marvel, we'll call her Jean Grey, are in the middle of a workout, practice session, and in the middle of it, Jean gets a little pissed off at Scott, Cyclops, because he snapped at her. And Beast is thinking that Scott's just agitated because she turned down his marriage proposal. I think his wife Madeline just died, so he's single and ready to mingle, or get married again, right away, to the chick he wanted to marry in the first place, before she died. And suddenly, the entire ship disappears, and they all go falling toward the street. So Jean uses her telekinetic powers to save everyone from going splat on the sidewalk, except for Scott's son Chris, little baby Cable. He has some kind of force field that prevents her from catching him, so Archangel has to fly down and catch him and carry him to the ground. Back with adult Franklin, he looks at the empty space where the big ship was and says to himself, "That's better." You know, I agree with him. I always hated that big damn ship. Worst, ugliest headquarters any super team has ever had, ever. Now back in that area that exists between here and now, I don't know what that means. Is he in Arizona? Is that where that is? So anyway, it's back to that alien cyborg creature, and we learn his name is Ahab, Master of Hounds. We learn that he really doesn't like Franklin, and he's really hoping to see him get killed. He's going to use his servants, these are other alien creatures he calls them his hounds, to find Franklin. Now one of the hounds refuses, so Ahab kills him, thus proving that he really is the Master of Hounds. Not a great nickname, but I've had worse. So back in New York, Ben, Sharon, Johnny, and Forge were heading toward the X-Factor building when it disappeared. They see X-Factor on the ground and they land for a little meetup. Sharon introduces herself to the mutant team, and Iceman and the Human Torch are oddly bro-ing down. "Yo, fire and ice," Iceman says. "The unbeatable combo," says Johnny. So Ben fills them in on what's happened back at FF headquarters, and meanwhile, we see that little baby Cable has taken a shine to the She-Thing. So X-Factor decides to join the others in their search for the adult Franklin. They fly off with their scanners, and one group with Beast, Jean Grey, Forge, and Human Torch, they almost get hit by this comet-like object streaking across the sky. They get close to it, and it turns out it's adult Franklin and Rachel from Excalibur, also a former girlfriend from the future. He seems to know her, but she doesn't seem to know him. Her memory of the future she came from is a bit scrambled, as we learned earlier. He's siphoning off some of her power, and she goes all Phoenix on him, and he says that she's not supposed to have so much power. Johnny feels like he needs to fly in to help adult Franklin, and Beast, who knows that Rachel is the daughter of Cyclops and Jean Grey from the future, asks Jean to go stop the Human Torch, and when Jean sees Rachel making that Phoenix effect, she's confused and asks the Beast, "Who is she? What's going on?" But he can't answer because the ship carrying him and Forge is suddenly attacked by those flying little drones. So Johnny and Jean turn back to help out, and meanwhile, Franklin and Rachel are having a conversation while they zap each other with their powers, multitasking. She asks who he is. He calls her his own sweet, gentle Rachel, and he freaks out and starts crying and says, "What happened? I never meant it to be this way. I only wanted you to love me. How can it have gone so wrong?" and then he seems to disappear in this bright flash of light. Johnny flies over to Rachel and asks what's going on, and she's struggling to try to remember who this handsome blonde shirtless man is who just said he loved her, and she's trying really, really hard. And then Jean Grey lands and says that she saw the Phoenix effect and wants to know who Rachel is, and Rachel blurts out, "Hello, Mother. I hadn't planned for us to meet like this." Elsewhere in another part of Manhattan, a ship carrying Ben, She-Hulk, She-Thing, not She-Hulk, She-Thing, Cyclops, Iceman, and Baby Cable, with Archangel flying by, nearby, they come across adult Franklin sitting on top of the Chrysler Building. They go over to help him into the Fantastic Car, when a couple of Sentinels pop up and start attacking. They fight him off, and they turn to ask what Franklin is up to. He says nothing, and then he disappears again in a flash of light. Beast pops up in a video screen to tell Cyclops that Jean Grey and Rachel Summers have just met, so he better get over there on the double. Time for a Summers family reunion. Ahab is watching all this on a video monitor, and he says he wants to destroy all of Franklin's protectors. Jean Grey, meanwhile, is pretty adamant that Rachel is not her daughter. Mothers, unlike fathers, always have a certain way of knowing if they've given birth or not. Rachel tells her that she's from the future, and Jean's like, "No, you can't be. You can't." Cyclops, holding little baby Cable, goes over to comfort Jean Grey, leaving Rachel feeling left out. She says that Scott and Jean were supposed to get married and have her as a baby, not a boy. But before her whining becomes insufferable, Ahab appears and harpoons her right through the stomach like she's friggin' Moby Dick. I love saying Moby Dick. He calls her his pride, his greatest warrior. He's the master of hounds, by the way. And in the future, she was a hound. And now that she's been harpooned, she turns into a ravenous, ghastly hound with pointy, jagged teeth and a long tongue that would make Gene Simmons jealous. And after hugging Ahab's leg in a gesture of complete subservience, Rachel fights through it, declares that she's not a hound, she's the Phoenix. And with a burst of energy, she returns to normal. Scott and Gene come over to comfort her, or whatever, and she screams, "You don't understand," and she flies away. So now this leaves the members of X-Factor, the FF, Forge. Oh, Forge, why Forge? We gotta have an actual X-Men to sell this comic, you know, let's include Forge. All the kids love Forge. So the heroes start fighting it out with Ahab and his hound creatures. And then, more help arrives. It's Reed and Sue, carrying the child, Franklin, Banshee, and the New Mutants, Rob Liefeld-era New Mutants. So the adult Cable is there with them. So they all join the fight. Ahab sees little boy Franklin, and he really wants that child. So he tries to harpoon him. But this isn't a Hollywood pool party. He's using an actual harpoon, and Franklin is protected by his mother and her force field. Reed notices that a time displacement field surrounds Ahab and his minions. Suddenly, Jean uses her telekinetic powers to pull Sue, Reed, and Franklin away from the battle, over to the Statue of Liberty with her and Scott. They discuss that Ahab seems to be using some kind of time displacement machinery, which they need to destroy. They find just the right spot to attack, and they have Johnny and Bobby the Iceman fire both flames and ice into the same spot at the same time. I guess it's kind of like pouring hot water on an iced-over windshield. The time displacement machinery starts to crack. Cyclops fires one more shot, and the entire machine explodes, and Ahab and his creatures disappear back where they came from. So with the battle over, we see that Archangel and Iceman were both badly injured in the fighting. Jean wants to have a talk with Scott about their so-called child, Rachel, but then adult Franklin appears, and he says that X-Factor fights really well for first-level mutants. And what do they know about the future? He looks at Scott and his son, Christopher Nathan Charles Summers, and says that he doesn't belong in this time, and zap, he takes little baby Chris away, and Scott suddenly becomes old and decrepit, and he falls over, seemingly dead. And that is the end of the story. We'll skip over the non-FF backup stories and right on to Fantastic Forecast, episode 346, part 4, New Mutants Annual 6 from 1990, part 3 of Days of Future Present, The Once and Future Mutant by Louise Simonson and Terry Schumacher. Yes, unfortunately, Rob Liefeld wasn't able to do the art for this issue, and that may be the first time in human history the phrase has ever been uttered, But I say that because Terry Schumacher's art is very unpleasant. This is why I hated the annual crossovers back in the day. They would have a few good artists working on annuals, and a lot of bad ones. The art in the FF annual by Jackson Geiss is okay. John Bogdanow's art in X-Factor was decent. He was never one of my favorite artists, but it's okay. And the art here in the New Mutants annual is just a sloppy mess. And the art in Part 4, the X-Men annual, is by Art Adams, one of my favorites. And the only reason I purchased these four annuals in the first place is because of Art Adams. So the story picks up with adult Franklin, who's visiting the Professor Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, and finds that it's become the Professor Xavier School of Rubble. The place has been destroyed. He was a student there. In the future, he uses his mutant powers, whatever they are. Who knows what his powers are? The character has been around since, what, 1968? And I still can't figure out what his powers are. So he uses his powers to magically repair the school. So he's got, like, the Molecule Man's powers now. Next, he uses his powers to put himself in an X-Men uniform, and then he enters the building. Back with Ahab, Master of Hounds, he finds adult Franklin on his scanners again and sends his hounds and his drones in for an attack. Down in the building's sub-basement, which I guess wasn't turned into rubble, the New Mutants are practicing in the Danger Room. I guess after helping out with the FF and X-Factor in the last part of the story, they rushed home, got there before adult Franklin, and began practicing in the Danger Room. It seems odd they would need to practice in the Danger Room in such a short time after they were in a real battle. They defeat the mechanical creatures they're fighting, and Cable says it's time to move them up to level 2. And then, adult Franklin appears with his own group of X-Men from the future, which includes one that looks like the dead New Mutant, Doug, a.k.a. Cypher, the guy whose powers were to translate languages, not a particularly helpful power for a team of superheroes, so of course he got killed. Rain and everyone of the New Mutants are surprised to see Doug, but they think it's part of the Danger Room. But Cable assures them that it's real, not a Danger Room simulation. Cable tries to get out of the control room, but the door is fused shut and he's trapped inside. Doug says he's alive, but he's really a robot named Magus, not Magnus, the robot fighter, but Magus, the fighter robot, father of the New Mutant robot, Warlock, not Adam Warlock, just Warlock. Ugh, someone at Marvel really should have done a little research before they came up with these names. So Magus bitch slaps Rain of the New Mutants, and Richter, the gay guy in the black leather vest, attacks Magus with his powers, seemingly killing Doug slash Magus. So the two teams have a brief fight until a hole is blown in the wall, and Cable leads his team out of the room. They come across an older guy with red hair and a beard and an eye patch, and they recognize him as Banshee and ask what the hell happened to him. Before he can answer, Franklin's team of future X-Men arrive. Magus is still alive and eager to kill the New Mutants. They get a look out the window, and it appears that they're in some sort of horrific future world. But Richter insists it's just some kind of illusion, and he says that Franklin's team of X-Men are an illusion too. And with this, Franklin loses control over them, and the future X-Men team fades away, leaving Franklin a sobbing wreck. He starts to glow, and he disappears into a glowing hole in the ground. Oh, don't we all wish we could go disappear into a glowing hole? Back with Reed, Sue, Little Franklin, and Banshee, they find their New Mutants and land. Reed and Cable meet for the first time, and Cable tells Reed about meeting the adult Franklin Richards. And then Reed fills him in on what he knows about the adult version of his son. Sue's checking out the scanner and detects hundreds of mechanical creatures coming from above. So yeah, it's time for more drones. And then some of Ahab's hounds show up, and of course, a huge fight breaks out. During the chaos, one of the hounds tries to grab little Franklin, but Richter zaps the hound, and he drops the kid. The hound grabs Richter by the arm and tells him that they're trying to save the future from adult Franklin, who plans to change history beyond repair, and adds that Ahab will do whatever he can, whatever he has to, and kill whoever he has to stop him. Little Franklin hears this, and is a little concerned about what his grown-up self is up to. Ahab shows up, and he harpoons that talkative hound in the chest, and just like that, Ahab disappears. So later, Reed gets another reading on his son from the future, so the FF and the mutants take off to go find him. And where is adult Franklin now? Well, he's at the Museum of Natural History. Oh, good choice. So much better than the Guggenheim. He summons up a better-looking version of Rachel from the future, and they're chatting. And then, a sentinel comes busting through the roof. The Fantastic Four and the other mutants arrive, and more hounds show up, and more chaos breaks out. Fake Rachel says to adult Franklin, "Help me, Frank, help me." And then she disappears. In a rage, adult Franklin uses his powers to fry up the hounds and the sentinels, much to the chagrin of the young Franklin, who looks on in horror. I'm looking on with chagrin and horror too, but in a different way. This story is terrible. And as the issue goes by, the art just keeps getting worse and worse. So the story finally comes to an end with the adult Franklin going over to child Franklin and saying that he will never use his powers in the future, and adult Franklin uses his powers to take away the powers of young Franklin. And as the adult Franklin fades away, he says the future he came from will never come to be. And to find out what happens next, we have to check out one more annual. So welcome to Fantastic Forecast, episode 346, part 5, X-Men Annual 14 from 1990, Days of Future Present, part 4, You Must Remember This, by Chris Claremont and Art Adams. The story begins at night in New York City, at a small diner, where we find Rachel Summer sitting at the counter, stuffing her face with a large hamburger and some fries. By the way, she's wearing the ugliest hat I have ever seen in my life. It's this big blue hat, maybe it's an urban sombrero, and it has about 40 little pink balls hanging down from the brim of the hat. I don't think anyone has seen so many little balls hanging down at once since the last party at Bryan Singer's house. Next, three armed thugs bust into the diner. They tell everyone to freeze. They're going to rob the place. Everyone in the diner raises their hands and complies, except for Rachel, who just keeps chomping away on her burger. The robber aims a gun in her direction and says, "Hey, are you deaf, honey bunch, or brain dead? Pay attention when I'm talking to you." She says, "Enough," and uses her powers to knock out the robbers and to twist and ball up their rifles. She takes a sip of her Coke and says, "That's better. The things a girl has to do to enjoy a meal in peace." Next, Rachel notices the adult Franklin standing in the doorway. She runs over to see him, but when she gets there, he's gone. She gets outside the diner and flies off. She's doubting whether or not he's real, even though she just saw him in one of the other annuals, so she should know he's for real. She knows there's an adult Franklin running around New York City. Of course, in the other annuals, she doesn't seem to remember who he is, and now she does. Is this a different Rachel? It seems like it. Franklin finally appears in front of her, and she does remember him, even remembers his nickname, Scrapper. He tries to talk to her, but she's a little hesitant. She's not sure if she should trust him or not, if he's for real. He asks her to read his thoughts to verify that he's real, and they move in close. Their lips get closer and closer, and soon they're kissing right there, floating in the sky over New York. And Rachel has some kind of phoenix orgasm and creates this huge, fiery phoenix light that fills the sky. Later, over on the roof of Four Freedoms Plaza, the Fantastic Four and X-Factor are joined by adult Franklin and Rachel. And Franklin says that he and Rachel have a second chance to live out their lives together in peace and harmony. Cyclops, as you can imagine, still wants to know what happened to his son, Christopher, little baby Cable. Reed adds that he also wants something to be done about little Franklin, who's still unconscious. And what about X-Factor's ship? I'm not sure why Reed would care about that ugly thing. I bet he'd be glad to have that monstrosity out of New York City skyline. "There's still Ahab to consider," Reed adds. And then he and Sue says they're still very proud of their adult son. They're suddenly grinning and smiling from ear to ear, incredibly chipper. Ben and Sharon wonder why Reed and Sue are acting so nice when little Franklin is getting worse and worse. Cyclops asks Rachel what she and Franklin plan to do now. Sue makes a comment to Jean Grey about her having a lovely child, and Jean snaps back at her that Rachel isn't her child. She's not even a parent, and she leaves in a huff and heads downstairs into the building. Reed and Sue, still all smiles and positive energy, give nice warm hugs and goodbyes to adult Franklin and Rachel. But after they're gone, Reed and Sue slowly return to normal and realize that adult Franklin has been messing with their minds. Back at the ruins of Professor Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters, I guess it's back to being ruined. I guess Franklin won't grow up to be a very good contractor. time to stick Adam Carolla on his ass. Storm and our new friend Gambit show up, and at this point, Storm has been turned back into a young girl. They find a hatch and enter the sub-basement of the mansion and find themselves face-to-face with Cable, who tells them that they're trespassing. Of course, Storm is like, "Hey, it's you who's trespassing." They fight for a little bit until the New Mutants, Banshee, and Forge arrive, and Forge recognizes his ex-girlfriend Storm, even though she's a little kid now. Soon, they fill each other in on what's happened. Why is Storm a kid? Something to do with a bad guy named Nanny. And Cable introduces himself as the new leader of the New Mutants. And why Banshee and Forge are there, and the adult Franklin Richards situation, Storm knows something about this future that the adult Franklin Richards came from. And that is, in the future, Franklin was killed. So this Franklin must be an imposter, or something worse. What's worse than an imposter? A clone? Maybe he's a clone. Those are always the worst. Back at FF headquarters, Cyclops and Sue are having a conversation about how mad Jean Grey is when Ahab and his hounds show up and zap the two heroes. In the living room later, the FF, X-Factor, and the New Mutants, Forge, Banshee, Gambit, Storm are all together talking about the future that adult Franklin came from. Storm says that the X-Men thought they eliminated that future when they saved a Senator Robert Kelly from being assassinated. Finally, someone shows up who knows about the storyline. Of course, I'm talking about Chris Claremont, who co-wrote the original Days of Future Past. Sharon says that she's worried about the child Franklin, who's still asleep. Jean says that she feels that something is wrong with Rachel, so they all decide they better go check this stuff out. Meanwhile, back with Ahab, Master of Hounds, he's got Cyclops and Sue held captive. We learn that it's his goal to keep the future from being changed again, and having the mother of Franklin and the father of Rachel is going to help. It's kind of convenient that they were alone together in a room while everyone else, the other 20 other people, were in the living room together. But anyway, Ahab uses his powers to turn Sue and Scott into a couple of hounds, mind-controlled, recostumed in outrageous get-ups, and forced to do his bidding. Sometimes, on the weekends, I dress up like a hound, but I do it of my own accord. So anyway, Ahab sends them off to find adult Rachel, adult Franklin, and Rachel. Speaking of which, the two of them are hanging out at Prospect Park in Brooklyn, along with Christopher Summers' little baby Cable. But the peace and quiet is soon interrupted by the Invisible Hound and Houndclops. Along with Ahab, Master of Hounds, they attack the young lovers. Sue puts her adult son in a force field with plans to compress it and crush him to a pulp. Rachel is planning to fight back, but suddenly her powers aren't working. Ahab uses his neural disruptor on adult Franklin and Rachel to scramble the synapses of their brains and knock them out. Poor Sue didn't get to crush anyone to a pulp. I really wanted to see that. So Ahab is being a dick to Rachel, but she's giving it right back to him. When a mutant proximity alarm goes off. I almost got one of those installed in my house when I moved in. They say installation is free, but the monthly service charge on the mutant alarm is a bitch. So a bunch of mutants show up, along with the FF. They bust into Ahab's secret hideout in a really great full-page splash page by Arthur Adams. Ahab sticks his hounds, including Sue and Scott, on the heroes. During the fight, Reed has Banshee scream at Sue, which knocks her out. After a few pages of fighting, Ahab hits a switch, making the floor glow, which knocks everyone else out. The only one left standing, or floating as the case may be, is adult Franklin, who tells Ahab he won't be hurting Rachel, he won't be hurting anyone for that matter. Ahab tries to get Rachel, one of the hounds, to attack adult Franklin, but she's able to refuse. So Ahab tosses his harpoon at Rachel, but Jean Grey gets up and tries to stop it, but she can't with her powers, so she just ends up jumping in the front of it. It hurts like a bitch, but she's okay. All the other heroes are now up, and Reed tells Ahab he's defeated, but he replies, "Sooner or later, I'll have your heads," and tells them to look at Cyclops and Sue as he disappears. So they look at Scott and Sue, who are still visibly turned into Ahab's hounds. They're just unconscious now that Ahab is gone. Reed says they have to find Ahab, and Rachel passes out. And Ben says that young Franklin is in a coma. Later, back at 4 Freedom's Plaza, they lay Sue, Scott, little Franklin, and Rachel out on the infirmary beds, and Reed tells He notes that it seems their lives are draining away before their eyes, and he kind of blames Adult Franklin. Storm reminds Adult Franklin that in the future he was killed. He shouldn't be alive and back in 1990. Reed theorizes that in the split second before he died, he cried out in a primal scream of denial, and this sent him back to the time and place he felt most safe. And I cry out in a primal scream of denial every morning when I wake up, but the only place I end up is sitting at the kitchen table eating a bowl of Count Chocula. So Adult Franklin wonders if he's real, or just a memory living off the powers of his younger self, which is why the younger self is in a coma. He's also stealing energy from Rachel. Gene says that at this rate, he'll suck them both dry. Hey Gene, watch it. This is a family comic. Adult Franklin says that he can't prolong his life at the cost of an innocent life, so Rachel gives him a hug, he tells her goodbye, and that he loves her, and he disappears. With Adult Franklin gone, little child Franklin wakes up, and Rachel has her full powers back. She uses her powers to return Scott and Sue back to normal, and she's back in her hound costume. She cries and flies off. Everyone is left wondering if that nightmarish future that Rachel came from will still come to pass, or if it's been changed. Reed tries to send a time probe to the future, but it hits that pesky time bubble, and it gets smashed into pieces. Reed concludes that the only way to determine the future is by living through it. Yes, the future is whatever you make it, so make it a good one. So the story comes to an end. We see that X-Factor's big ugly ship is back in Manhattan. Everyone says goodbye to each other. Storm says she's going off to find the rest of the X-Men. And later that night, Jean Grey is back at her parents' house, looking at a snow globe, this kind of memory orb or something, with a photo of herself and Rachel, and wonders if it's her destiny to have that child. Nope, actually, it's Jean's destiny to die again, and 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 again. So that's it for this extra special, supersized episode of the Fantastic Forecast. We'll be back next time with the first part of a three-part story guest starring Wolverine, Spider-Man, Hulk, and Ghost Rider, with guest artist Art Adams making his return. Yay, more Art Adams. You can download other episodes at iTunes and find them all at www.podcastff.podbean.com. You can also join the Facebook page at www.facebook.com/podcastff. And if you have any questions about the Fantastic Four, about this podcast, or if you need relationship advice, you can email me at podcastff@gmail.com. So long, kids. This podcast is finally over. When it hurts to be out there, where I know I don't care, I've got the silence of you. Frustrated by the people's lies.